Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we conclude our two-part series of commentary by environmental leaders about what happened in 1995 and what they hope for in 1996. Then Jeffrey Canada, children's advocate and author, presents a portrait of a block in New York City. He shows us that special places which affect the spirit can be found in cities where we work and live, as well as in the wilderness. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. If there were an environmental almanac, it would note that in 1995, the United Nations Conference on Women convened in Beijing. A decade ago, few people talked about women's issues and environmental issues as being synonymous. But that has changed. Increased understanding about the direct relationship between economic opportunity for women and family size bodes well for women and the environment. Another cause of optimism is the progress being made in the phase-out of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. Those are the chemicals found in old refrigerators and air conditioners, which destroy the ozone layer, exposing us to more solar radiation. While efforts to protect the atmosphere are beginning to pay off, the effort to protect parks and special places within America has not fared so well, as our commentators report.
I'm Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University, and I'm a member of the Advisory Council of the Environment Show. During the last year, I've been pleased to see that a number of countries in the international community has made substantial progress on the issue of how one controls the vast overpopulation that we have on this planet. I've been saddened, however, to say that there has been not only no progress on trying to limit consumption among the rich, but in fact, a lot of countries, like many of those in East Asia, have begun to imitate the consumptive patterns of European countries and the United States and Japan. So that's pretty grim. One has to remember that the entire world's environmental situation is tied together. The epidemiological environment, the problems of the resistance of bacteria to antibiotics and of emergent diseases tie us all together. In a world where the population food situation is getting worse, we're not doing anywhere near enough about it. One of the cheering things, though, is that an analysis that Ann and I and a colleague just published in a book called The Stork and the Plow is that anything one does to help improve equity around the world between sexes, races, religions, countries, and so on can help us solve our environmental problems. I'm Paul Ehrlich.
I'm Diane Dillon Ridgely, National President of Zero Population Growth and a member of the Advisory Council of the Environmental Show. 1995 was an extraordinary year. The bright spots were very positive and all too few, and the negatives give us our greatest challenges for 1996 and beyond. But I'd like to focus on one of the high points, not only for 1995, but one of the major shifts to occur in the last 10 years. This past September was the Fourth World Conference for Women in Beijing. Central to the language of the agreements and to the understanding of all countries' delegations was the centrality of environment as a focus for that conference and to the future of progress for women. In 1985, at the Third World Conference in Nairobi, precious little was said about environment, and even less was understood of how it was part of the women's agenda. With the progress that we've made since the Earth Summit, and especially at the Population and Development Conference in 94, this has turned around completely, and I think it's one of our real treasures that we should take as a victory in 1995. Again, this is Diane Dillon Ridgely. Thank you.
I'm Paul Pritchard, president from the National Parks and Conservation Association. 1995 has been a very challenging year for our national parks. Nearly 270 million people visited America's national parks. Despite the park's obvious value to Americans and tourists from around the world, Congress has failed to support the parks. Early in 1995, members of this Congress were promoting a blatantly anti-park agenda, a war on our national parks. Example, one of the first bills to come out of the House Resources Committee would establish a Parks Closing Commission. Many Americans joined us in defeating this bill for now. In fact, a dozen other anti-parks bills were still waiting action by this Congress. The Park Service is being asked to manage the Mojave National Preserve in California on only $1 a year. National parks in Alaska will be given away, and many urban units of the National Park System, the Presidio in San Francisco and the Richmond Civil War Battlefield, are on hit list. In early December, the world's first national park, Yellowstone, was declared a World Heritage Site in danger, a sad commentary on the plight of our crown jewels. It is no secret that the national park system is struggling to survive on a grossly inadequate budget. This Congress is not focusing on helping the park system. How the parks fare during 1996 in Congress will depend largely on you, the American people. Once these precious areas are sold off or logged or developed, they are lost forever. The parks need your help. Make your voice heard by your members in Congress in 1996. The National Parks and Conservation Association will help you do that. I'm Paul Pritchard.
I'm Richard Mell, president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. This has been a very challenging year for everyone working to protect historic places, and despite our best efforts, it's apparent that America's cultural heritage is very much at risk. Even though every year millions of people visit famous places like Mount Vernon, Civil War battlefields, and the hundreds of historic sites that are contained in our state and national parks, many of them don't realize that all of these places would have disappeared forever if somebody hadn't taken extraordinary steps to preserve and protect them. Each year, when the National Trust for Historic Preservation names America's 11 most endangered historic places, you can almost hear a battle cry from coast to coast for saving them. But beyond these, there are hundreds more that are left either to deteriorate or are bulldozed away. Often people don't realize their own commitment to historic preservation until there's an issue literally in their own backyard. Also, there's another threat to historic places, and that's the lack of adequate funding for our national parks. Many people don't realize that the National Park Service is charged with protecting and enhancing so many historic places that continue to play a role in our heritage. How can any nation say that its heritage is important if it doesn't back up its words with action? What does that say about our values and about the strength and sincerity of our commitment? Still, there have been some encouraging signs. The National Trust and its partners have made good progress toward enactment of a homeowner's tax credit that will provide a tremendous economic incentive for people to restore the older houses of our small towns and cities. We know through our own heritage tourism program that in 1994, visiting historic sites was the second most popular type of family vacation. And we know through the increasing strength of local preservation organizations that more and more people are realizing we have to revitalize our older communities by reusing historic structures. We have learned how to recycle everything from newspapers to cars. We have to learn how to recycle communities as well. This is where I believe the real battle to preserve our heritage will be won, building by building, block by block, and neighborhood by neighborhood. I'm Richard Moe, president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
This is Jonathan Lash, president of the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. I'd like to tell you a success story that holds promise for 1996. January 1, 1996 will mark the end of production of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, for use in the United States, a very important step in protecting the Earth's ozone layer. The adoption of alternatives to CFCs has been quicker and cheaper than anyone expected, as U.S. industries responded to clear deadlines, flexible rules, and strong financial incentives in the form of a tax. The result was a wave of often profitable technological innovation and big benefits for the environment. As concern about other global environmental problems, global warming, loss of biodiversity, forest destruction, rises, it is worth considering the lesson of CFCs, the the combination of clear deadlines, economic incentives, and flexible rules that encourage innovation can produce remarkable progress once the nations of the world agree upon and commit to a set of goals. This is Jonathan Lash.
If you've got anything to say about the environment or the Environment Show, write us at the Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or you can try our new homepage on the World Wide Web. It's at www.wamc.org/env. Still haven't been able to get there on the web? Try it again. It's www.wamc.org/env. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we conclude comments from the environmental professionals who take a dim view of what went on in Washington in the last year. Then Jeffrey Canada takes us to 108th Street in Harlem in New York City and presents a portrait of his special place. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show.
Hi, I'm Gene Karpinski, the Executive Director of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, the national lobbying office for state PIRGs across the country. The 104th Congress has been the most anti-environmental in history. Why? Because this Congress, under the leadership of Speaker Gingrich and Majority Leader Dole, has been engaged in a massive effort to roll back 25 years of environmental progress. That's right. The corporate polluters and their allies in the new Congress have been trying to weaken, gut, and roll back the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and many other laws that we care about. That's the bad news is. The good news is the American public is starting to fight back. In town meetings, in phone calls, in visits, they're sending a loud and clear message to Congress, stop the rollback of environmental laws. Just last month, an effort by the PIRGs, the Sierra Club, the National Audubon Society, and groups around the country delivered 1.2 million signatures on an environmental bill of rights saying, stop the rollback of our environmental laws. The question from 1996 is, will politicians get the message? Will they keep listening to their corporate contributors who say, roll back our environmental laws? Or will they listen to their constituents who say, protect public health and protect the environment? We need more environmental protection, not less. We need to stop this rollback. And we need President Clinton, who's finally begun to realize how important the environment is and speaks about it, we need President Clinton to veto environmental rollbacks again and again and again until Congress gets it right. I'm Gene Karpinski.
My name is John Adams. I'm the Executive Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. 1995 was one of the toughest years on record for the environment. In my 25 years at NRDC, I have never witnessed such an aggressive, brutal attack on the nation's bedrock environmental and public health safeguards. But we have turned a corner. The laws that protect our air and water from pollution and our lands from exploitation have come under relentless assault from the Congress and from the special interests. They thought they could take these laws away from the public, but they were wrong. They tried to rewrite the Clean Water Act to allow more sewage and industrial pollution into our rivers and our lakes and streams. Some in Congress proposed to repeal the Clean Air Act entirely and remove the ban on ozone-depleting CFCs. And now they're offering to sell off our priceless national parks, our public lands, and our wildlife refuges. In short, many in Washington are ready to destroy 25 years of bipartisan support for the environment. But I believe their efforts will fail, and there are many signs that the public is now beginning to win. In 1996, we expect to see more victories for the environment and to expose the special interests behind these anti-environmental attacks. We plan to let Congress know that we won't stand for backdoor attacks disguised with front porch platitudes. Congress is toying with the very safety and protection of our drinking water, air, and land, but this is no game. With public help and awareness and action, 1996 will be a better year for our environment than 1995. I'm John Adams.
I am Jonathan Plout, Director of Environmental Quality for Allied Signal of Morristown, New Jersey, and a member of the advisory board of this environmental show. My company helped get NAFTA passed in 1993. We continue to believe that the agreement will yield significant long-term benefits for the environment, for workers of all three countries, and for the companies. Sound environmental management is an important part of the success of NAFTA. We continue to make significant gains in the area of employee health and safety and in reducing emissions in the U.S. and Mexico. We have been encouraged by Mexico's commitment to raise its environmental standards. The NAFTA Environmental Commission gives us and other leading U.S. and Canadian companies the opportunity to share our expertise with our Mexican counterparts. I am particularly keen, for example, on the cooperative training that industry of the three nations, including my company, will carry out in Mexico City in January 1996 on the ISO 14000 proposed standards of good environmental management. I am Jonathan Plout.
My name is Doug Costell. I helped put EPA together 25 years ago and was its administrator from 1977 to 1981. We've all been disturbed by the virulent anti-environmental actions by the Congress this year. But I would like to sound a more hopeful note as this year draws to a close. I truly believe that common sense and our yearning for moderation and integrity will again civilize the political process, at least to the point where thoughtful people will prevail and over ideologues and special interests. It's important that that happen. Much has been accomplished environmentally in this country in 25 years. The air and the water are cleaner, but most importantly, environmental values are now a permanent part of our political value system. But as our industrial economy grows, we keep raising the bar. More significantly still, as the world economy grows, we raise that bar considerably more. We will of necessity have to continue our quest for greener technologies and more sustainable practices with respect to consumption of both energy and natural resources. The good news is the efficiency inherent in this greening of the American industrial base will be essential if we are to compete in a global economy that will itself be ever more competitive in its demand for capital and resources. So that, used properly, these forces will push us towards further progress in our evolution toward a more sustainable future. The bad news is there's no unseen hand guiding these choices. The job of fashioning public policies to bring the right choices will remain the challenge for us all. Vigilance is the price of liberty, and participation is the responsibility of all of us. Make your voice heard. This is Doug Costell.
This is Mike Robbins, editor of Audubon Magazine and a member of the Environment Show Advisory Group. In 1995, Washington is where the action was, and in 1995, a lot of that action was pretty dismaying for environmentalists. The 104th Congress launched an assault on the landmark environmental protection laws that had been passed with strong bipartisan support over the years. There was an effort to reopen the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration. And while talking about good environmental news in 1995 is a little like asking Mrs. Lincoln how she enjoyed the play, there is some good news and some reason for green optimism in 1996. Some key pieces of environmental legislation, like the Endangered Species Act, did not come up for reauthorization and therefore did not get gutted as threatened. President Clinton, sensing support for environmental issues at the center of the political spectrum, said he would veto any bill that opened the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to the oil interests. But in the end, the political development that promises to have the greatest impact on environmental issues in 1996 and beyond is a bill about green stuff, all right, but it's not about old-growth trees. It's about money. I'm speaking about the recent and surprising effort to curb the spending and influence of lobbyists on Capitol Hill as part of a drive to reform campaign financing. That's important now because in 1995, there was an especially direct connection between major campaign contributions and lobbying by such industries as oil, chemical, timber, mining, and land development interests, and congressional efforts to gut our environmental laws. Congress is even considering ways to curb political action committees and soft money contributions to political parties. That'd be a truly green law. I'm Mike Robbins.
We all have places which are special to us. These can be places deep in the wilderness or in the middle of a city. Earlier this year, we heard from children's advocate Jeffrey Canada. He's the president of Reedland Center for Children and Families and author of the book Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. Canada works in a tough neighborhood in Harlem in New York City, and he presents us with a portrait of a city block.
A city block in New York is like no other place. You have to live there for years before you really understand that these are not just streets with buildings, but these are stories with heart and soul. This block, 108th Street, tells one story to those who come to visit, and another for those who have stayed a while, for those who look, for those who listen. Broadway acts like a line of demarcation. West is all luxury co-ops and condos. The affluent on the Upper West Side see a different block, hear a different story. Walk just east 20 yards, and 108th Street has another story to tell. The block is beautiful. An old Roman Catholic church sits squarely in the middle of the block. The white stone statue of the Virgin Mary perched atop the steps leading to the church gives an aura of serenity and peace. If you look up, you can see lovely stonework, adjoining arches, detailed window ledges, beautiful brick. I have walked up this block for 13 years. It is the way I walk to my karate class. I know there are many stories this block could tell, so many sad tales. Sometimes when I'm walking in the early morning sunlight, I hear the stories, the secrets of 108th Street whispered to me. The whispers are carried by the wind as it blows from east to west. You probably wouldn't hear it, but you haven't walked this block for 13 years. Do you remember little Ronald? How fast he could run, how nimbly he dodged between the parked cars. He was always running, running to catch a football, running to catch a baseball, running just to be running. He never saw the car. Running can be a problem on 108th Street. And what about Hector? Always laughing and joking, always out too late. Whatever happened to Hector? Some say he's in jail. Some say he moved. I know it was AIDS. Another secret whispered only to me on 108th Street. And Ralph. They shot Ralph right across the street from the church. Another story of senseless death on this block. In the autumn, when the wind blows the leaves on the trees, you can hear Ralph's laugh. Well, I can hear it. You probably need to walk this block for a few more years. But Victor and Rachel, they're in college now. I still hear their once secret dreams of getting off the block, making something of their lives. And there are other little ones who play on the block now, and they laugh, and I watch them play handball and tag and jump rope. They are black and brown and white, children having fun on a city block, a block like no other, and one, unfortunately, like too many others. They can't hear the soft whispers on 108th Street. I can. Sometimes those whispers make me laugh. Sometimes they make me cry.
Jeffrey Canada is president of the Reedland Center for Children and Families and author of the book Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 312. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long. And join us next week for the Environment Show.